whoever says the most, the loudest, repeatedly, loudest voice, they win. They shape the perceptions, whether it's actually occurring or not. I think it's that two-way dimension and preference, once they come together, combined with an algorithm that's designed to give you more of what you want, just creates this alternative universe that is hard to know what is true.
That was Clint Watts, national security, counterterrorism, and cybersecurity expert. Clint Watts was formerly an FBI special agent working in counterterrorism and formerly at West Point's Combating Terrorism Center. He is currently a fellow at George Washington University's Center for Cyber and Homeland Security and at the Foreign Policy Research Institute. He is a national security contributor for NBC News and MSNBC. He is the author of Messing with the Enemy, Surviving in a Social Media World of Hackers, Terrorists, Russians, and Fake News, which came out in 2018, a book, by the way, which I very highly recommend, and which we will be talking about, among other things, today. Welcome to Vital Interest. My name is Karen Greenberg, and I am the director of the Center on National Security at Fordham Law School. Our podcast is designed to help you understand security in its many dimensions. Each week, we will bring you thoughtful voices from the worlds of policy, government, law, journalism, and advocacy. We will look at the challenges that confront us today and tomorrow, from pandemic to climate change, from terrorism to population migration, from war to peace, all with an eye towards the rule of law, the protection of human rights, and the respect for civil liberties. Vital Interest Podcast is committed to making the world we live in more comprehensible, the part we play in it more engaged, and our futures more secure. It is our way here at CNS of connecting with our times and with one another. Welcome, Clint. Welcome to Vital Interest Podcast.
Thanks for having me.
It's really interesting when I look through the many periods of your life that you've had, from Al-Qaeda to Russian hacking, Russian disinformation, to domestic extremism today. And one of the things that links it all together is the internet. You say the internet brought the world together. Social media has torn us apart. So I thought before we got started, you might help distinguish for our listeners the difference between how you see the internet, how you see social media, and is there a boundary? And if there is, how do we understand it?
The first time I got on the internet was actually a mile and a half behind me at West Point. I actually am up there right now. And I remember going to class and they were like, this is the internet. And we were considered advanced because at West Point, we had email in 1991. That was unusual. And it was the Department of Defense email system. They already had that. And hence they were working on the internet. And I remember seeing it the first time, and it took like 4 minutes to load a picture, you know, or something like that. You know, it was like impossible. And then I went in the Army, and I remember when they had a giant meeting to give my first company commander an email address in like 1998, right? And so it was happening. And within 2 years, by 2000, the year 2000, I became an infantry company commander, and we had vehicle tracking with screens, and we were trying it out. It was like all part of this modernization. And then 9/11 hit. And then within, you know, a couple more years, I worked at the FBI as an agent. I quit. I was back at the Combating Terrorism Center at West Point. And then I started working for the FBI again. You know, I was hopping back and forth, and each installment, the internet had changed in each of those time periods. Like, you could feel it. And so the big difference with the internet versus social media is the internet was still mostly one way. It was a place where people put up information and shared it. And then you would watch Al-Qaeda in Iraq. Well, I should say Al-Qaeda first, but then Al-Qaeda in Iraq, they kind of knew what they wanted to achieve with it. And they did, which was, you know, connect with, inspire, radicalize, and recruit people online. And they were doing that on scale. And it was YouTube in the beginning. And so you could see this two-way dimension start to occur. And then if you fast forward to the Arab Spring, you see revolutions. And what is that about? That's people organizing, coalescing around ideas. They don't know each other. They don't even know what the idea is. They just know to mobilize. And that's that two-way dimension. And it all seemed great until preference came along. And preference is what social media's doom is. Once everybody continues to choose what they want, who they like, which are people that look like them and talk like them, once their status quo bias sets in, once they start to herd, they completely have a reality distortion that suits their preferences. And it's been fascinating to watch that I started doing these crowdsourcing surveys right around bin Laden's death in 2011. And it was just starting. It was just a way off my blog to survey people because everyone said, oh, if you put it out to the crowd will always get it right. And I kept putting it out to the crowd and they got everything wrong, like everything wrong. And I was like, why is this not working? And it was the start of the herding effect that your community online was putting you adrift. It was creating a different perception of reality. And so I wrote an article with one of my West Point classmates called The Wisdom of Outliers, and that it was people with on the ground experience. It was people with expertise that were kind of buried by the mob that were actually more inclined to have the right answer. And now if you fast forward, that was 10 years ago, the crowd and the mob controls the perspective. Whoever says the most, the loudest, repeatedly, loudest voice, they win. They shape the perceptions, whether it's actually occurring or not. I think it's that two-way dimension and preference, once they come together, combined with an algorithm that's designed to give you more of what you want, just creates this alternative universe that it's hard to know what is true.
So, but we still have outliers.
Yes.
And who would be our outliers?
Yeah. So we set up a system to detect outliers. I actually created like a mathematical system based on how people ask questions in surveys. And I was always looking for people who would only break on 1 out of 10 questions against their herd. And then I would look at why, and they almost always would answer in the other box of the survey. And they would almost always say, I know everyone's going to say this, but it's actually this, and here's why. And they would tell you. And in the answer, they would say, let's say Iraq. I served in Iraq from 2005 to 2008, and I was in that town, and that's not what happened. And you'd be like, huh, okay. I actually have 2 master's degrees, one in national security, but another one in, I'm just making this up, hypothetically, epidemiology. And I know this is how COVID-19 might travel. And you go, okay. Or I have a language experience and my family is from this area. And I just culturally know that this isn't quite right. There's something not correct with it. So it really came down to crowds were really good at things that they experience or knew about, and really bad at things that they've never encountered before. And so you got to switch your paradigm. That seems obvious now, but in the crowdsourcing like boom, it was kind of like, just send a survey to everybody and they'll tell you the right answer. I was like, well, what's the best place to eat ice cream? For sure. How do you get to Brooklyn the quickest? Okay, what's going to happen to Al-Qaeda when bin Laden dies? No. They're not going to do very well. I met a lot of resistance with that, but I see it today as how do you find the outliers, you know, in the crowd?
So is there a way to restore some of the preference for the individuality, the expertise, which we've seen deteriorate, you know, the respect for expertise, particularly under the last administration? Do you see a way forward for this, a way to restore some of that individuality and trust in experience and expertise?
I think it's happening right now, a little bit.
Okay.
So QAnon, Q did not surface. President Trump did not stay as president. I call it the reality horizon. Every one of these things has a reality horizon where ultimately the consequences of a false perception or a false belief ultimately hit you, and then you have to absorb it. COVID-19 is a great example of that. There were warnings. I remember discussing it with friends who are in financial space. They tend to take it a little more serious and were thinking about it more, which is why no one reacted till the market crashed, right? Like they were on it before everyone else. But it took a disaster, right? You didn't have leaders or elected representatives who were doing that, who were trying to steer us in the right direction, even if it wasn't good for them politically. Vaccines, another example. The one that worries me the most is climate, which is we're already too late. It's already hit in my mind, and it's just we have to deal with it. And those sort of things worry me. Is it the reality horizon hits after the perception status quo, and you have to suffer a consequence to really redirect? That's where I'm worried right now.
One of the things I wanted to talk about was information warfare. Fake news. And you've spent a lot of time thinking about Russian interference in the 2016 election and somewhat in anticipation of the 2020 election. Are we any better at forestalling information disinformation, information warfare going forward? Have we learned enough from 2016 and 2020?
Yes. I think we did much better incrementally in both 2018 and 2020, for sure. There's only one vulnerability in the system right now, and that's the politicians and the elected leaders.
In what ways?
If they are willing to take the support of a foreign nation or partner with them or amplify their disinformation, it becomes impossible for the institutions which are led by those elected officials to do everything they can to stop it. This time around, Rudy Giuliani was with a guy named Andrei Dukach, who was sanctioned by Trump's own Treasury Department. They were spreading disinformation and propaganda and conspiracy straight from Russia into the United States. And then doing that, and I think the second layer is media outlets were having Rudy Giuliani on spouting that story and those conspiracies. So it left this problematic situation where both the U.S. government and the social media companies hit a limit of advance where they can no longer defend. And if they do, then they are vulnerable to counteraction by elected leaders who are doing oversight. Now, the Republicans are very worried about being spied on. You know, it's interesting how that dynamic will switch around. And then for the social media companies, they can't put their finger on what needs to be policed because they're not sure what is foreign or domestic, what's malign interference or campaign stunts. It comes down to those two layers, I think of the remaining two layers, where if we're going to do this all the way, this is it. We know the last two gaps, and we can't really beat up on the institutions this time. I think you look at DHS, CISA with Chris Krebs, General Nakasone, and the NSA and Cyber Command, FBI, the Foreign Influence Task Force. I mean, everybody, Chris Wray, you know, came out and gave video speeches, you know, at the same time as Rudy Giuliani is like advancing conspiracies about laptops, and New York Post is publishing crazy things. And you just get to a point where you're like, okay, this is as far as we can go until the leaders shape up. You know, there's just not much more you can do.
Well, that's kind of interesting because it brings into question something else you've talked about and that lies beneath a number of the things you work on, which is how robust is our government in terms of its knowledge of what the malign actors can do, will do? Actually, how good is their analysis? And because you often write about bureaucracy and, you know, not kindly.
And, no.
Right.
It's a weakness actually of mine, which is, and why I'm working out of a garage, which is I have great disdain for it. I understand its purpose. We need systematic rules and set implementation and scale and all that. I think there are so many barriers on different parts of the U.S. government to do what their so-called mission is or what they're assigned to do. I know we need oversight, but it's also political oversight. So I see where the conundrum comes from, but it then lets it so that the institutions become so weakened in their performance, their mission, that they can't do it, even what they probably logically know they need to do.
I mean, bureaucracy can be a good thing, right? It can make things work. And I guess that's what Biden's challenge is, to restore bureaucracy to being able to function effectively and efficiently.
I think you see it already, right? I can feel it. Like, holy cow, the government is back.
You know, one of the things that you've written about in your lengthy Substack pieces.
I know.
But they're very good.
Things an editor would hate is what we should call my Substack.
And you start, I think, the first one with this by saying the insurrection came later than we thought.
Yeah.
Right? Please explain that to our listeners because it's actually fascinating.
Yeah. So I have a team that watches both foreign malign influence and domestic extremism. You know, we work on this stuff. And probably by the end of the summer, after watching the storming of the Capitol in Michigan, it was like, okay, these guys are mobilizing and they're waiting for someone to point them to where to go. Mm-hmm. And I thought, this time we don't worry about the Russians. Like, they'll do what they're going to do, but it's going to be people showing up with guns. And I thought that'd be election day. And where I was wrong was on election day, people still thought Trump could win. And so they did not show up to interfere. They showed up to monitor polls. And then after that happened, we were still on high alert that there would be some sort of interference at vote counting facilities. And it did happen. You know, there were a couple of QAnon supporters arrested in Philadelphia. Mm-hmm. There were some other places where people showed up and we were just waiting. And we watched the Proud Boys rallies in, I think it was November, December, you know, in the Capitol. And then 3 weeks out or so, you could see this January 6th thing. And we were like, that's when it will be. I was not surprised at all by January 6th, the volume. And we started turning more attention to it by the weekend before. And as of that day, we turned everybody we had to January 6th. That's all we did for a few weeks, a couple of weeks.
I want to talk a little bit about domestic terrorism, but first I want you to explain what you mean when you say what you've said repeatedly, my team.
Yeah.
Tell us.
So I have a consulting group and, you know, we're always doing tracking and we try and support different clients who want to understand foreign malign influence, election interference, but also extremism. And right now we got a really fascinating project I'm proud of about vaccine disinfo and how do we help you know, with that. And so that informs a lot of my thinking, you know, about some of the things I write. The domestic extremism posts I did on Substack was really the product of watching everything my team is reporting. And so I'm very lucky. I have my own team that's just constantly reporting like everything they see in lots of different ways, Russia, Iran, China, other foreign states, and then the domestic groups around the insurrection. And that overlaps with all conspiracies, everything from QAnon to vaccines to anti-mask.
And you're studying open source, just collecting tremendous amounts of open source material.
All open source, no covert stuff, no inauthentic stuff. So this is open source monitoring, and it's the same thing all the way back to when I did Al-Shabaab and Al-Qaeda versus ISIS, and how do you measure the splits? Same thing. Because honestly, I think you can get a better perspective of any open sort of group. Not Iran, right? Iran is a closed system, not North Korea, but of society in the open social media platforms than you can in the government in a lot of ways, because they're not allowed to look at it or store it or triage it. They're not allowed to use those systems. And that might be a good thing, you know, legally. And they're focused on very like tactical operational things.
There's so many questions about these domestic extremists, right? And I guess my one question is, there's been a lot of talk about their similarities to jihadi groups, that not only the name, the base being borrowed, but also tactics, strategies. How do you see this? Do you see this as central to domestic extremism, or do you see it as something that experts are making too much of?
I think it's central to understanding. It just shows how many experts there are from the terrorism era now that have perspective. You know, we just didn't have it in 2001, and 2021 we do. But we have 20 years experience of this. So I think the similarities are that you can see these pathways from highly centralized terrorist group to cellular to totally grassroots, which build up the other way. That was kind of ISIS operated that way. And to me, the domestic extremist groups operate a little bit more like the ISIS model. And that's because social media, they were powered by the social media engine of connection and communication. And it really brought people together. What was interesting to me was what brought people together was a battlefield, you know, for ISIS. Let's go to Syria and then Iraq. For Al-Qaeda, it was different, right? It was like, let's attack the United States and then the battlefields form. And now let's bring a franchise together and go there. And ultimately it led to their undoing. They couldn't control a affiliate halfway across the planet of people they've never met. So the same phenomenon now is more like, I should say, when Obama was elected, that's when the white supremacist push started to happen. And the discussion spaces are there, and you have mainstream and fringe media discussions and social media coming together. That's 2009, 10, 11. You could see it build to where then when you have a catalyst, the leadership change of 2016, that catalyst unites disparate fringe ideas that don't always agree. In fact, if you're in the same room, I think January 6th is a great example of that. Oath Keepers, Proud Boys, Three Percenters, then online, this morass of crazed extremists, one-off shooters in El Paso, these sorts of places. What you saw was this start to build to the base. You know, by 2016, 17, you could see these groups coming together as cells, Adam Waffen, the base. Now you'll see it with groups that are on the fringes called like Patriot Front. Mm-hmm. You'll see splinters from the Proud Boys and Three Percenters and Oath Keepers. So there's a very dynamic tumult that reminds me a lot of how ISIS kind of grew until they met resistance, and then they splinter and then they grow again or they reunite. And it becomes that amoeba that's constantly moving because there's still momentum in it to a degree.
Well, one of the things that was always of interest in looking at jihadist terrorists was training. You know, it's one thing to have an ideology and another thing to have training in which to carry out acts of terrorism. How do we understand training when it comes to these violent extremists, domestic extremists?
What I find interesting about them is they know they need it. So, you know, where Al-Qaeda, I want to talk from the U.S. perspective. The challenge for them was always you had to have someone who could get into the United States. We could train them. We could radicalize them and then get them in was the hard part. And then once they were here, they couldn't get weapons or explosives or things. It's a reverse problem from the domestic terrorist perspective. We got all the guns we want, right? Like if I'm a domestic extremist group, I have a belief system. I know people around me. I've got lots of access to targets. But unless I have a former military or former law enforcement officer or something like that, I don't have an in-house trainer, which Al-Qaeda would recruit, you know, even our own special forces guys, right? They would bring them in to like help with training. So on the domestic terrorist front, they need to do that. And that's why you see groups like the base immediately try to go to, let's build a base so that we can train, so that we can do things more dynamically. I find that remarkable that both groups coming from opposite directions realize they need this point where they bring people together and train them in a way that they can then plot and plan attacks. Otherwise, it's the stochastic terrorism online crew and whoever happens to pull off the best attack, right? There's no real thought. There's thought put into it, but not a ton. What do they strike as a target? Is it busy that day? Does the person know how to operate the gun? It's really hard to even create the model to understand how dangerous any one of those attacks would be, because it just really comes down to the individual.
Coming back to the uses of the internet and social media, but how effective do you think that social media can be in countering the call to the base and extremism?
The social media companies always react too late. Yeah. Now, they've gotten better. So I remember my first conversations in the late 2000s. It still always got to, well, what makes them a terrorist? Because there's a million other posts of people talking about we should do something, or we should kill somebody, or I hate someone, right? Like, what makes it that? And ultimately, the standard comes down to, what does the government say is legal and what is illegal? What is a terrorist and what is not a terrorist? What's a terrorist organization, not a terrorist organization? They kind of got that fixed in the international space because everyone hated the Islamic State and everyone hated Al-Qaeda. And once the government moved, it was like, okay, we're taking down Al-Qaeda. So turns out if guy has an Osama bin Laden picture as his avatar, might be an Al-Qaeda supporter, right? Like, they had defined things that they could go after. Not the case. QAnon is a great example, which it's like lots of people supporting things that are kind of violent or seem to be violent or have cross-linked membership. But membership in what? And is it a formal group? If I say, I think we should go kill Nancy Pelosi, right? That was a common thing you would see in social media. I think we should kill Vice President Pence. That was something else you would have seen in the lead up to January 6th. I'm going to police that Pence. You know, they're probably like, yes, he's the vice president. It'd be like every congressman that gets threatened with death. That would be all day. That's all we do all day. So you get to this weird point where there's no domestic terrorist designation process when things fall apart and the social media companies hesitate and they pull back. And then if they push forward, they get beat up for free speech. And I honestly believe while they're always going to lobby and try and push legislators to not do anything, they would be okay with whatever comes out because they'll know what to police then. Like, they would like to have kind of like a, okay, government says police this, do it. And then they're not in the Jack versus Zuckerberg debate, which is, what does my profit model say, you know, in terms of taking this stuff down?
Right. So here we are in this new century with these new capacities that sort of seem have gotten out of the box before, you know, we were able to get on top of them that may not be able to be restrained. And so that leads me to something else you've talked and written about, which is what's happening to critical intelligence. Because ultimately, when you look at these things, you know, it comes down to, are you foolable or not? Are you influenceable or not? And where do you see us on the journey from being so susceptible to fake news to a society and a culture that is less vulnerable to the fake news phenomenon, the disinformation, misinformation phenomenon?
I admire what the counter disinfo communities have done. You know, the counter extremism communities have done. There's been a lot of good tools. I like the NewsGuard function. I wanted to build something like that. They built it and it's pretty good. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of advocacy groups for literacy and social media literacy and those sorts of things that have come up. And so I think they should be proud of what they've done. Ultimately, the last variable is people and what they want to believe. And I did it as a joke in 2016 because I'd see stuff I knew to be Russian propaganda show up on my own Facebook feed. I would try and argue it. And they'd be like, no, look over here, you know, and they would cite something crazy. And I would say, believe what you want. And I did it kind of jokingly, but now I really realize people will, to a degree, believe what they want. That's always been the case to a degree. It's just, you've never had people influence each other in such a way on scale across nations. You just couldn't do it. If you remember the late 70s, right? People are like, there's aliens out there. You believe it? What brought people together? Close Encounters. Close Encounters like brought it, right? And there was an era of like alien type shows, but it faded because no one could keep it going. You just could not keep making alien movies and this or whatever, right? It just kind of died off. And so I had a t-shirt as a kid that said, I saw a UFO in Ellsbury, Missouri, because they thought they had seen one, like out of a cornfield. It was like a cult following out there. But it died off, right? There's no way to sustain that. And there was no way for people to manipulate behind that to keep it going, the way QAnon has really played out. There are people manipulating on scale other humans to believe in this totally bonkers conspiracy. That's what I think it comes down to, is people's demand to believe and also their demand to connect on that belief. I don't know that you can unwind that as long as there's social media.
On the other hand, you're suggesting that there may be a lifespan to these things, even with social media. It'd be interesting to know what that lifespan is.
Someone will drink the Kool-Aid, you know, eventually, and there's a shock in the system. I think COVID had that to a degree, where it was, it's fake. You can't talk to any Americans now that haven't been affected personally by someone who's been severely ill or died. I do think that's part of the change from a year ago. Whereas it was kind of limited to New York City and some major urban areas, Washington State, we knew, right? If you were in New York, you could hear the sirens all day. You knew what that was. You knew people that died. We didn't have that shared experience of like a 9/11 where everyone watched it. And if you had a good administration, this is where a government can come in. You can help people have the shared consequence, right? Like, we could have done things in March and April had we had better leadership to let people understand, like, wow, this is the devastating effect of what's going on in our country.
Right. So it's some combination of the government being vigilant and proactive, and ultimately of some kind of critical intelligence kicking in at some point, right?
Yeah.
Well, that brings us to my last question, which is the same on every podcast, which is, what are you hopeful about?
The younger generation, they are awesome. They work hard. They're very smart. Compared to when I was their age, they have a tremendous amount of experience and education that I did not have. They seem to genuinely want the world to be better and to do things better than their parents. Whereas I just didn't even really think about it. Mm-hmm. Working on election defense and interference with them has been fantastic, watching how quickly they move and recognizing that it's time for me to step aside, you know, to a degree. There's no way I can keep up with technology like that. That's my big takeaway, I think, from particularly last year, but the last few years, is that if we get out of the way, they'll probably do just fine.
Clint Watts, thank you so much for joining us. Everybody should read your book. First of all, you're a good writer. Second of all, you're funny, which I really appreciate.
People always ask me, why are you so serious on TV? I'm like, I only show up when something awful has happened. So
it's no, that's exactly
not
right.
Like you can laugh.
It's a very entertaining book, and it does what very few books do, which is take us from the time of in the early century and, you know, Al-Qaeda all the way to now, through Russia, through the elections, to really how the narrative that the countries followed in terms of threats and counter strategies for so long, and how they're tied together across many different issues. So thank you so much for sharing your thoughts with us today.
Thanks for having me on.
Thank you for listening to today's conversation. We hope it made your day a little brighter, a little clearer, and a little more informed. Join us next time for the newest installment of Vital Interest Podcast. In the meantime, feel free to send us your questions at vitalinterestpodcast.org and to follow us on Twitter at @VI_podcastCNS. And make sure to check out our daily morning brief, our weekly cyber brief, and our Vital Interests online forum at CenterOnNationalSecurity.org. Have a wonderful week, and please stay safe.